Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, it's great to have you along today. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross at the controls, Chris is at the phones, and we've got a great hour ahead. We'd say that every day.
It's true, though.
Yeah.
You're not lying.
Okay. that's faith, I think. What's that old joke about, applause before a speech is faith, applause during a speech is hope, and applause at the end is charity, or something like that. So anyway,
applies it often in situations.
You can, bring your applause out anytime. We're going to talk about getting real, about getting close. In fact, that's the subtitle of a new book that I know you're going to enjoy the discussion about, because I think all of us want to experience closeness not only with each other, but with God. And that's really at the heart of Faith Radio. We talk about connecting faith to life every day.
Yeah. But that means warts and all sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yes. Yeah. And we're going to... No, we shouldn't have said warts, I guess, when just before I introduce my guest.
But I'm sorry.
No connection whatsoever. we are really honored to have John Ortberg back with us. John's senior pastor of Menlo Church in the Bay Area. He's an author, of course, best-selling author and speaker, and written books like The Life You've Always Wanted, Faith and Doubt, Who Is This Man, Soul Keeping. Has a new book out called I'd Like You More If You Were More Like Me. And with that, let's jump into the conversation. John, welcome to Connecting Faith. Good to have you on.
Neil, it's great to be on, and I wish so much I could be there in person in St. Paul every time of year. I miss that so much, living as I do now in California, where it's just always sunny and 75 degrees, but we all have to suffer in our own ways.
Well, yes. Well, this actually, and I think today is actually one of the nicer days, so we're not sure how that happened, but we're glad to have you on. Love your writing and just the way that you help us think through important issues, getting close. And I know this, we'll talk about the word intimacy, which, some of us don't necessarily know what that means, or maybe have some myths about it. But I guess I thought, in terms of starting out, as we talk about having an intimate relationship with God or other people, I think all of us want that. But what keeps us from experiencing that closeness? I mean, it doesn't just happen automatically, does it?
No, I think a lot of times somewhere we pick up this idea that it just ought to be easy. And there's an awful lot of, for lack of a better word, kind of romanticized thinking about them. When you look at a movie or you listen to fairy tales, it's just about meeting the right person and then you live happily ever after. And a lot of times, even when we talk about God, there'll be that same kind of unreality. That, if you just have enough faith or if you're really devoted enough, life is simply this perpetual experience of connectedness and closeness with God. And I think the untold secret in the experience of an awful lot of people is I'm not having that sense of ongoing connection with God or with people in my life, and I often feel alone and I often feel an ache, and I think I'm probably the only one, Loneliness is one of those interesting dynamics where very few people will raise their hand to acknowledge I'm lonely. We often will around, yep, I'm hurried, I'm too busy, I've got too much to do. But loneliness has kind of a stigma in our day, but I believe underneath the surface, everybody listening to us wrestles with it.
Well, maybe we should just start out by talking about defining what intimacy is and then maybe some myths about it, because, the culture certainly has a different view, I think, than what the scripture provides for us.
I heard a definition years ago that really is what inspired me to write the book. There was a guy who taught philosophy, wrote about God and faith, named Dallas Willard, who became a huge influence on me and many of us. And he was talking one time about life, and he said, your life basically consists of a conscious flow of experiences. Way more than you're a body, you are this awareness of a sunset, a beautiful piece of music, a conversation, a work project, That is your life. And then he said, intimacy is shared experience. Hmm. Intimacy is shared experience. And I had never thought about intimacy in that way before. I think a lot of people, when they hear the word intimacy, they think either it's sex or it's romance or it's restricted to people that are married or it only exists for people who are real, you know, touchy-feely herbal tea drinkers. And that idea that it actually is a very concrete thing that anybody can learn. Anybody can learn how to get connected to God or get connected to other people. And it really is around something as simple as offering to share my experience of this moment with God or with another person.
Mm, I love that it can be learned, and I hope that during our time together we'll learn more about it. One of the statements that caught my attention early on in the book, you state, intimacy can't be coerced. And then you said, God doesn't want compliance, he wants connection.
Yeah.
What a great line. Develop that idea a little bit.
Well, you know, one of the most important ideas that gets talked about in the Bible is obedience. And Jesus calls us to obedience. There's this great statement I was just thinking about this morning, John 17:7, where Jesus says, if anyone chooses to do the will of my Father, they will find out if my teaching is from God. But very often, when we hear that word obedience, we think compliance, we think behavior, we think this kind of militaristic, rigid, just following the rules. And that's not what God wants. Another thing that Dallas said one time that really struck me was, sometimes it's possible for people to get so obsessed with doing what Jesus said that we fail to become the people he wanted.
Hmm.
And what he really wants from us isn't the grudging, resentful obedience of the elder brother in Jesus' story about the prodigal son. It really is that we learn to share our experience with him from one moment to the next. So like right now, as you and I are talking, it's possible for me while we're having this conversation in my spirit, in my mind, to be saying, now, God, I'm talking to Neil. I'm not exactly sure what the best thing is to say, and I'm likely to worry about how's this going and how do I sound. So, God, would you just help guide these words and help to get said what needs to get said? Help me to depend on you and let go of the outcome. And then even while I'm doing this with you, I can be sharing this experience with God. And that's how we build an intimate relationship with God from one moment to the next and one task to the next.
You start out the book talking about the table, and of course, you know, as Scandinavians, we all know that that's pretty much the center of any house and family. But it did you bring in the that wonderful verse from Revelation 3:20, which I think, you know, is appropriate here as we talk about, you know, God wants connection with us because, you know, God is interested in the table as well, isn't he?
Yeah, for anybody who's listening to us right now, I love this image, and it's how I start out the book. I grew up, my people are Swedish people, and when I think about love, I think about a table, and I think about this house on Brennanwood Terrace in Rockford, Illinois, where my dad and my mom and my brother and my sister and my grandma and I, we always sat in the same seats. Nobody ever made assignments. We never voted on this. When anything would happen, when somebody would win or lose, when there was birth or death, we would gather around the table. And that image of community and connectedness and unhurried joy entering into each other's lives, I do believe that's our deepest hunger. And for so many people who are listening to us right now, Neil, we get so rushed. We literally don't have time to sit at a table anymore, and we get to the end of our lives, and, you know, we have been dominated by these giant to-do lists, and we spend more time trying to climb ladders or chain to a desk than we do sitting at the table. And that invitation that Jesus gives, you know, I stand at the door and knock, and if you'll just respond, I'll come in and eat with you and you with me. I will sit at your table and invite you to be with me at the table. I love that picture.
Coming up in a moment, we're going to get more of a picture about what intimacy looks like, what it means about getting real, about getting close, the subtitle of John Ortberg's new book. And we're going to be reminded that we're created for deep connections. In fact, there are some very interesting ways in which we are created specifically for a connection. And we'll talk about things like attachment and, differentiation and linkage and all those kinds of important words. It's not actually a science class, no, but John Ortberg has some good insight for us to share coming up in the moments ahead. John is a senior pastor of Menlo Church in the Bay Area, best-selling author and speaker, and he's joining us today to talk about the book, I'd Like You More If You Were More Like Me, his latest, and we've got a couple of copies to give away. We'd love to get one in your hands. Give us a call. We'll put you in the drawing for that. Do a drawing at the top of the hour. Call 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And you can sign up for a copy of John Ortberg's new book. And we'll continue our conversation with him in just a moment. Honesty needs to be certainly part of a strong and healthy relationship. We're talking about getting real, about getting close. We're created for deep connections. When people have deep connections, we can win at life. And John Ortberg has written about it in a brand new book called I'd Like You More If You Were More Like Me. John, of course, a senior pastor at the Menlo Church in California, best-selling author. He was a teaching pastor for a number of years at Willow Creek Community Church. He's also on the board for the Dallas Willard Center for Spiritual Formation, and we've benefited from his connection with Dallas Willard, and has really Dallas is one of his mentors, and I just so appreciate John's writing and all his books. And this one is another opportunity for us to understand what it really means to connect. And in fact, John, you talk about going back to even babies, that God has wired us. Infants need attachment, but you say adults need separation for attachment to work. Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, we are hatched to attach. And we all have this tremendous longing to belong, but it is a dance of being separate and being connected. And it's fascinating to me. If you look at Genesis, basically what God does in creation is he separates and then he joins. So he separates the light from the darkness and then joins them to create a day. Separates the sky from the earth, separates the dry land from the waters, and then joins them to create our planet and to create weather. And then when human beings come along, he actually separates the woman from the man and then joins them together. And one of Jesus' statements is that which God has joined together, let no one put asunder, let nobody separate. So that image of separating and then bringing those separate elements together in a new unity with a higher level of complexity to create greater flourishing, that's at the core of creation. And human community is kind of the climax of that. And so when we're born a little baby, actually that's what's going on in their brain. Their little neurons get differentiated, and they're scared and they're vulnerable. And then their mom will say to them, or their dad will say to them, reassuring words, don't be afraid, I'm here. When our daughter Laura was less than a year old, Nance would always say to her either, honey, 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 or I know, I know, I know. And that got so wired into Laura, when she would wake up in the morning, if we didn't go in to talk to her, she would start crying. But instead of just normal baby crying, she would lay in her crib and go, honey, 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 I know, I know. And we would laugh and laugh, and she's in therapy to this day. But that vulnerability and need and then connection and attachment is deeply wired into the human experience. And I find it fascinating, Neil, that the number one statement that a mom will make to a little baby, don't be afraid, I'm here, is also the number one statement that God makes in the Bible to human beings. Fear not is the most frequent command. And the reason for it always is, for I am with you. And I think it reflects how deeply we were made to attach. And just like humanly speaking, we can have attachment disorders when babies don't get rightly attached to their mom or their dad. There is a kind of divine attachment disorder. And we all experience that because of sin, where we feel this sense of distance or withdrawal or alienation from God. And that's what he wants so much to overcome by inviting us into an intimate relationship with him.
Somehow, though, it's when we, you know, we assume coming to God that we can't be vulnerable, that and we don't even want to do that with our, you know, with our spouses or with others, right? I mean, we put up these defensive walls instead of being vulnerable.
Well, you know, ever since the fall, when you think about vulnerability, that story in Genesis says about the man and the woman, originally they were naked and were not ashamed. We never heard that verb preached on much in the Baptist church where I grew up, but the idea about it was they had nothing to hide. Imagine being fully known by somebody. No secret, no shame, no I wish you didn't know that. To be fully known was their great joy. And then what sin means is I have these actions, these words, these lusts, these lies, this greed, this envy, where I'm afraid if you knew about them, you wouldn't love me. And so to be vulnerable, to be fully known, which is still my great desire, is now also my greatest fear. And that's where we get so stuck in our relationships. And that's where only the foundation of being utterly accepted and utterly safe in the love of God, I believe, can provide the safety for people to be vulnerable in human relationships. We talk a lot about, you know, I don't know if this is a safe person or I don't know if this is a safe place, but I believe Jesus' intent is we actually carry our safety along with us. Paul says, for I'm convinced that nothing, height nor depth, life nor death, can separate me from the love of God. And that's what makes me safe and enables me to be vulnerable with another person.
You know, I was thinking on the other side of that, you address it a little bit as well, that sometimes lack of self-awareness limits intimacy. That's kind of the other side, isn't it?
You know, there's a whole book in that topic. Yeah, it's... often relationships are like a bad American Idol audition where everybody knows this person can't sing except for the person that's singing. And that's the problem with self-awareness, of course, is everybody else sees this truth about me except for me. And that's part of why we need each other so much, because you'll be able to see pride, arrogance, deceit, anger, defensiveness inside me that I'm blind to myself. And it took me, has taken me a long time to learn that love is not blindness to my faults. Somebody who loves me sees them fully and challenges them, but in the context of deep acceptance, because they want for me not just to be comfortable, but to grow into my best self.
Which is what we want, you know, ultimately want in that direction, getting real about getting close. John Ortberg, my guest today, talking, If You Were More Like, I'd Like You More If You Were More Like Me, his new book. There's a difference between fitting in and belonging, too. You address that. Say a bit more about distinguishing there.
Yeah. Well, it gets to really the title of the book, I'd Like You More If You Were More Like Me, refers to the fact that I believe the number one barrier to relational closeness and intimacy is just human differences. You know, I'm mostly an introvert. I like solitude. I like to think about stuff. My wife is a raging extrovert. She has never had an unexpressed thought or feeling. Often when I get home at the end of the day, she will say, how did your day go? And I will kind of feel like, you know, I used up all my words. I got no words left. I gave them all at the office. And she can never understand that because she never runs out of words. She's like the Niagara Fall of words. And the very qualities that drew me to her in the first place, just this free spirit, very expressive, extremely verbal, those very qualities that draw us to another person often become the qualities that become problems for us on the other side. And then it starts to feel like, why can't you be more normal the way that I am? And what will often happen then in a relationship or in a community, sometimes in a church, is I'll get this feeling, I would be accepted by people, I would be loved if I was the person that they want me to be. And as soon as I start thinking that, then what I'm tempted to do is to perform or to pretend like I am that person, that I'm more competent, that I'm more verbal, that I'm more loving, that I'm smarter than I really am. And what happens then is I'm fitting in. Fitting in means I'm pretending to be somebody that I'm not in order to gain acceptance from somebody that I want. And the problem with that, of course, is at a deep level, even if I'm good at fitting in, it terrifies me because I know if they really understood who I truly am, they would not love me. So I become a victim of my own ability to be a chameleon. To belong means to be accepted for who I am. To fit in means to be accepted for who I'm not.
Bring that into the terms of relationship with God as well. Talk about there's a difference between union and communion with God, and that kind of ties into what we just talked about with the human relationships as well.
Well, you know, one of the huge problems in spiritual life and in many, many churches really is the issue of performance and this sense that I have to perform enough, I have to believe with enough faith, or I have to give enough, or I have to do more in order to get God to really love me. And so this distinction, an author named Rankin Wilborn writes about this, between the two concepts is that union can be understood as the relationship that I have with God because of the fact that God loves me that will never change. God's love for me will never change. His desire to forgive me will never change. His desire for me to become my best self will never change. His good will toward me will never change. Communion can refer more to my subjective experience of God in my life. And that will vary quite a lot. It can vary based on how much am I intending to surrender to him or not in this moment. It can vary based on how tired I am or what kind of mood I'm in.
We'll talk more about this important issue with John Ortberg coming up here in just a moment on Connecting Faith. In fact, he's going to share with us the core secret to human connections found in the single command. We'll get to that and more, talking about his new book, I'd Like You More If You Were More Like Me, Getting Real About Getting Close. Talking about getting real, about getting close, the subtitle of John Ortberg's latest book. I'd like you more if you were more like me. The fact is that we are different. But does that mean that we can't develop deep connections? We're created for deep connections, as John was saying a little bit earlier. But, you know, God does that work of differentiating, of separating and then joining together in something even more wonderful. And talking about intimacy, what that looks like. John's senior pastor at Menlo Church in the Bay Area, California, best-selling author and speaker, and he served as teaching pastor in Willow Creek Community Church for many years, serves on the board of Christianity Today International, on the board of the Dallas Willard Center for Spiritual Formation, and part of Fuller on the board of Fuller Seminary as well. We're honored to have him with us on Connecting Faith. We've got some copies of his book to give away, and we'll do that drawing here at the top of the hour. of it. John, one of the things you talk about, it's just a great line. I thought I'll give you a chance to answer the question. You say, the core secret to human connection is found in a single command given by the Apostle Paul, and we're always looking for core secrets. So what's the answer?
Yeah, it's so simple, and almost everybody listening to us will have heard this command. It might, in fact, be the single most often violated command in the New Testament. And it's when Paul is writing to the church at Rome, and it's this simple: rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. And it's very interesting, even when he talks about people who are mourning, he doesn't say fix people who mourn or give advice to people who are mourn. And it turns out that precisely this engagement, this command to rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn, is what a skilled parent automatically does with a little baby. And babies need this deeply. If you just watch a mom or a dad at work when they have that little baby, if that little baby smiles, you'll see that parent smile and say fun words or give a little laugh or give a little shake. And what they're doing when they do that is communicate to the baby, I am watching you, and not just that, I understand what it is that you are feeling. And if that little baby is crying, same thing. The parent will make a sad face. They will often embrace the child, say soothing words to the child. And what they're communicating at a real deep level to that baby is, I understand what you are feeling. You are important enough for me, another human being, to enter into your world, your emotional world, your spiritual, personal world, and to take on inside myself what's going on inside yourself. And that very process is what contains the miraculous seeds of personal growth and development and healing in sorrow and sharing of joy. And Paul actually says that's what, if we're following Jesus, we're commanded to do with each other. And if people take nothing out of our conversation except that, if you just go through this day and really observe people to find out what's going on in their spirit right now, and everybody is either we're always either a little bit on the rejoicing side or a little bit or a lot on the mourning side, one way or the other. And if you notice that and then respond in such a way that says to somebody else, I have seen what's going on in your spirit, and I'm willing to take that on in my spirit, you will exercise relational genius, and God will give you connectional blessings with people.
I assume that part of this is really just being a good listener, or I think maybe you talk about being an intimate listener.
You know, years ago I was talking to a friend of mine, a Christian psychologist by the name of Neil Warren. He actually went on to start eHarmony. But I was talking about being a dad and how do I do that well, and he said, it's just like in real estate, the basic three laws of real estate are location, 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 that the basic law of relationship is observation, observation, observation. And this is true for parents with their children. It's true for people listening to us who are married with their spouse. It's true when you go into the office as you look at coworkers or when you go to school. Most of the time, most of us are so preoccupied with what we think we have to get done that we look at the people around us, but we never see them. And, of course, the amazing thing about God is that he notices us. And this is just part of that remarkable statement in 1 Samuel, when it says, man looks on the outward appearance, God sees the heart. And we're actually able, as God helps us, to see what's going on in the hearts of people around us and to respond to them. And we can all learn to do this.
You tell a story in the book, because many of us have had experiences where, you know, relationships haven't gone well. We have been mourning, and others, you know, maybe we're piling on. You talk about rejection therapy and the sting of the word no. Tell that story.
Yeah. It actually, I saw it online because it was an amazing story. Then it turned out that the guy who did the video that I saw attends one of the campuses that's part of our church. And it gets to the issue of rejection. You know, we all hunger for acceptance. We want somebody to be for us and to delight in the fact that we exist. And therefore, there's a unique pain to rejection, and we are exquisitely sensitive to it when another person's will is set against ours. Even somebody that looks at you in the long way when you're driving a car can set you off for a while. And there was a man, again, somebody who attends our church, who was realizing in his life, relationally and vocationally, he was just crushed by rejection, and he was going to have to learn to deal with this. And so he embarked on what is sometimes called rejection therapy, where to help you learn to overcome your fear of rejection, you deliberately court being rejected at least once a day just to learn that you can survive it. And so he would make an outrageous request of somebody, you know, knock on somebody's door and ask if their kids could play soccer in the backyard or something, just to deliberately get a no. And then one day he went to Krispy Kreme's and he asked the woman behind the counter, would you create a five donut arrangement for me where the donuts are made in the shape of the Olympic rings and each decorated with the appropriate colors? And he was waiting for the no, but instead she actually said, you know, I think I can do this. And much to his shock, he didn't get rejected. And he put this on YouTube, and it's been seen by I don't know how many millions and millions of viewers. And so this idea of it's possible with God's help for me to overcome my fear of rejection and my scars and wounds around rejection because I am accepted by God and God will never reject me. And that can actually enable me to grow in my courage and my ability to seek to accept other people, even if they're trying to reject me. And, of course, our ultimate leader in this, as in everything else, is Jesus. And the cross is the ultimate place of rejection therapy, where humanity's rejection of God actually turns into God's great acceptance of humanity.
And yet, I guess, as a fellow Scandinavian, I know that, you know, maybe it's not so much fear rejection, but I go into, as you say, the gift of pouting. Well, how do we overcome that?
This kind of gets to what's the fundamental building block of intimacy. And a researcher by the name of John Gottman, he's kind of a leading guru around relationships and marriage in particularly, writes about this in a really helpful way for anybody listening to us. And the idea is this. Intimacy, we often associate with being touchy-feely or being reserved for people that are you know, deeply emotionally expressive. And Gottman says it's much simpler than that. He says that people are constantly making what he calls bids for connection or bids for intimacy. And it will look as simple as somebody saying to you, have you had coffee yet at the office, or did you see the game last night, or have you read this book, or have you seen this cat video? And when they're doing that, they're not just conveying information. They're actually saying, would you like to connect with me? Very often, we miss those bids. We don't realize what's going on. And Gottman says we can respond to those bids in one of three ways. We can ignore them. You know, I'm busy. We can reject them. Nope, I don't want to do that. Or we can accept them. Yeah, let's go have coffee. Or I'd love to do that. Can we do it a little bit later? Something like that. And we can all grow in our ability to recognize and respond well to bids. As a Scandinavian, one of the things that we're really good at is being hurt and upset by rejection, but not acknowledging that we're hurt and upset by rejection. So we don't actively get mad or say aggressive things. We just withdraw and deliberately ignore somebody, don't look at them as much, don't touch them as much. And we do that just enough so that they're aware of the fact that we're withdrawing from them, but not so much that if they call us on it, we have to admit that we're doing it. That's the spiritual gift of pouting.
Let's see if we can eradicate that. Thanks to your book, if you were more like If I'd like you more if you were more like me. I should get that title right at some point here during our conversation. Just got a couple minutes left. Maybe just, you know, for those that need to, maybe a relationship's been a little ruptured, you do talk a little bit about some steps to repair. Let's just highlight a few of those.
Yeah. Another skill that people can really acquire is the capacity to do relational repair. And it's kind of like, you know, if you're driving a car and a tire starts getting low, you really want to stop and repair it then, because if you keep going and it blows out and then you damage the rim, and, you know, and sometimes we're more sensitive to that in our machines than we are in our relationships. So the place where repair begins is awareness of, is there a rupture in our relationship? And that occurs anytime somebody experiences a ding. You know, one of the ways to think about relationships is often if I get in an argument with somebody, let's say my wife, because that happens, my goal will be to win the argument and to come to an agreement together. Anytime one person loses, the relationship loses. And so my goal is never to win an argument or to prove that I'm right, but to seek to grow and deepen our relationship. And people that are really good at relational repair are people who get really good at reading their own emotions and knowing, how upset am I right now? How angry am I right now? And my wife has told me that there have been times in our relationship, and I think I am getting better at this, but particularly in early years, when the look on my face would convey contempt to her, and that would be very hurtful to her. And I wouldn't even be aware of the level of contempt that I was communicating. And so people who are good at relational repair become self-aware of, what am I experiencing right now? And if my brain is really flooded, if my emotions are really hot, I may need to just take a break and let my body cool down until I'm able to respond to the other person thoughtfully and not just reactively.
We've got just a little sampling of some of the great insight available in John Ortberg's new book, I'd Like You More If You Were More Like Me, Getting Real About Getting Close. We have a couple of copies to give away. You can sign up for it at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. John's best-selling author, speaker, and the pastor at the Menlo Church in the Bay Area. And John, we're just honored to have spent some time with you. Thank you for carving it out today and for giving us some good insight today and through this new book.
I'm super honored for the time, Neil. Thank you very much, and just rich blessings on your life and ministry.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, and during the next few minutes, we're going to reflect on world-renowned, beloved evangelist Billy Graham's life. Billy went home to be with the Lord today at age 99, and we're going to hear some highlights of his life and ministry in just a moment. But we have a special place in our hearts, love for Dr. Graham, because his was the first voice heard when Faith Radio went on the air 69 years ago in 1949.
The building and construction of this station, we owe largely to the sacrificial gifts of the student, faculty, and staff of the Northwestern schools. And today we're grateful for these over 1,000 students that have come from 42 states. And so today this station stands as a monument to answered prayer and the sacrificial giving of the greatest gang of students, and faculty, and staff, I believe, anywhere in all the world today.
That's the voice of Billy Graham, who passed away, went to be with the Lord today at age 99. And we're going to spend the next 10 minutes just reflecting on his life with this special report from Greg Clugston.
This is an SRN News special report, the life of Billy Graham, a servant of God. Here's SRN News correspondent Greg Clugston with a look back at the man and his ministry. Over the past half century, Billy Graham was the most well-known Christian evangelist in the world.
Peace will prevail, and Christ will be King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That's the day I'm looking forward to.
Graham preached the gospel to more people in live audiences than anyone else in history. Over 210 million people in more than 185 countries and territories.
His influence reached far beyond the church, touching the lives of millions of people in untold ways. He was a regular fixture on the Gallup organization's most admired polls. A friend to American presidents and foreign heads of state, this country-born preacher traveled the world over with a single purpose, to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. Graham said, his one purpose in life is to help people find a personal relationship with God.
I cannot argue anybody into the kingdom. I cannot debate anybody into the kingdom. There has to be the preparation of the Holy Spirit. The preparations of the heart are the Spirit, says the Scripture.
Billy Graham was born William Franklin Graham, Jr. in 1918 near Charlotte, North Carolina. He was the oldest of four children. Billy's father was a successful farmer and businessman. Both of his parents were Christians, and the family attended church on a regular basis. At the age of 16, Billy committed his life to Christ after attending a series of revival meetings held by a traveling evangelist. During his college days, Billy was baptized at a Baptist church and began his lifelong membership in the Southern Baptist Convention. He earned a theology degree at Florida Bible Institute and, from 1940 to 1943, attended Wheaton College in Illinois, where he not only graduated with a bachelor's degree in anthropology, but met his future wife, Ruth Bell. After pastoring his first and only church, Graham joined Youth for Christ, speaking at youth gatherings in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. He was seen as a rising young evangelist and eventually began to hold his own rallies. In addition to his preaching duties, Graham served as president of Northwestern Schools in Minneapolis for 5 years. During this period, he gathered several key members of his evangelistic team, including popular soloist George Beverly Shea and choir director and master of ceremonies Cliff Barrows, members who would stay with his ministry for decades. Thanks to his engaging personality, his creative style, and his unquestionable passion for preaching the gospel, Graham became well known within the country's evangelical and fundamentalist circles.
The crime, the fraud, the immorality, sex perversion, all of these things are gripping our society right now. And unless there's a reversal, we could see God's judgment fall upon our country and fall upon the world.
In 1949, a crusade in Los Angeles thrust Billy Graham into national prominence. The landmark evangelistic campaign in L.A. drew record crowds, 350,000 people. It lasted 7 weeks and resulted in the dramatic conversion of many people, including a prominent disc jockey. He hosted rallies in major U.S. cities and expanded his preaching stops to Africa, Asia, South America, and Europe. Graham's name recognition grew rapidly thanks to media coverage. In November 1950, Graham turned to the broadcast medium for mass evangelism. He launched the Hour of Decision radio broadcasts, still heard on hundreds of radio stations nationwide.
And today, again, I'd like to welcome you to the Hour of Decision with Billy Graham.
In 1951, Hour of Decision broadcasts were expanded to television, and Graham formed a film ministry later called Worldwide Pictures. Graham founded Christianity Today magazine in 1955. He also authored a syndicated newspaper column, and his ministry published Decision magazine. In the 1980s and 90s, television was used to reach increasingly larger populations, culminating in the 1996 Global World Missions satellite broadcast with an estimated potential audience of 2.5 billion people.
And in my travels around the world, but especially in the United States, I find that the great Achilles heel in the church today is the lack of prayer. We don't pray enough, and we don't pray with the right attitude toward in our hearts.
Graham wrote more than 24 books, all of which became top sellers, including his 1997 autobiography, Just As I Am. Throughout his career, Graham was honored in both the secular and religious arenas. Recognitions ranged from the Congressional Gold Medal to the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion. He was regularly listed by the Gallup organization as one of the 10 most admired men in the world. Unlike some popular American preachers, Billy Graham and his ministry were never subject to scandal. T.W. Wilson, a childhood friend of Graham's and a ministry associate, said Graham adhered to a strict code of conduct.
Billy will not be alone in a room with his secretary or ride alone in a car with his secretary because, you know, he takes the scripture literally. It didn't say avoid evil. It said avoid the appearance of evil.
Wilson went on to say that Graham was always concerned about protecting his testimony. Despite his widespread appeal, Graham had his critics. According to the Billy Graham Center archives at Wheaton College, the evangelist offended different people for different reasons. Fundamentalists accused him of ecumenical evangelism that corrupted the gospel message. Liberal Christians often wrote that Graham didn't care enough for helping to ease social problems. Some attacked the Crusades as mechanical spectacles, and others felt he was too close to world leaders. This was especially true in the 1970s because of Graham's friendship with Richard Nixon, who was then entangled in the Watergate scandal. Billy Graham had a long-lasting and unique relationship with U.S. presidents. His White House connection dates back to President Truman. He viewed his contact with presidents as an important ministry opportunity.
It has made me very conscious of responsibility because I felt I would never leave the office of one of them without having witnessed to them about Christ.
In a 1998 Oval Office interview with SRN News, President Clinton discussed the value of his relationship with the evangelist.
He's a very great man, but he has great feeling for other people. He doesn't have an arrogant bone in his body. He has a great sympathy for the human condition, and he lives his Christian testimony probably as well as anyone I've ever known.
The Reverend Billy Graham participated in 9 presidential inaugural activities dating back to 1965. His final such appearance was in January 2005 for the second inauguration of President George W. Bush.
Our Father and our God, we thank you that the last event of this historic week is a time of worship, a time to hear your word, to pray, and to declare our dependence on you. We acknowledge your divine help in the selection of our nation's leaders throughout our history. And we believe that in your providence, you've granted a second term of office to our president, George W. Bush.
In 1992, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association announced that Graham had Parkinson's disease and would be easing back on his busy schedule.
I have a few things that are wrong with me physically, which comes to as you get older.
In 2000, Graham's son Franklin was appointed CEO of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. And in the summer of 2005, Billy Graham held the last of his 417 crusades.
And tonight, I want to say it's great to be back in New York.
For 3 days, the evangelist preached before huge crowds in Flushing Meadows, New York.
Are you ready to die? Whether you're a young person here today or an old person like me, you'd better decide for Christ here and now.
During the New York City rally, Graham acknowledged that this would be his last official evangelistic crusade.
I'm getting too old to do this. This may be the last time I'll have an opportunity to preach the gospel to an audience like this and to have Cliff Barrows here and George Beverly Shea.
Graham was preceded in death by his wife of 64 years. Ruth died in June 2007 following a long illness. Her death came just a few weeks after the formal dedication of the Billy Graham Library, which was attended by former Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Carter. Billy and Ruth Graham had 3 daughters, 2 sons, 19 grandchildren, and numerous great-grandchildren. For more than 50 years, they made their home in the mountains of North Carolina. In November 2013, Graham celebrated his 95th birthday with the release of another book and a 30-minute TV broadcast called My Hope America.
There is no other way of salvation except through the cross of Christ. Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father but by me.
From the age of 16, when he became a Christian at a revival meeting, until the final day of his life, Billy Graham dedicated himself to God and to the preaching of the gospel.
I don't expect to live forever, and I'm ready to go to heaven. In fact, I'm looking forward to it any day.
This has been an SRN News special report, The Life of Billy Graham, a Servant of God.
Over the next few days, you'll be hearing more as we highlight and reflect and remember the life of Billy Graham, passed away today at age 99. What a legacy. And we're grateful here at Faith Radio for the part that he played in the launching this radio ministry. Well, if you missed part of today's program, want to hear it again, you can always find our podcasts. We post them on our show page, the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. Click on Connecting Faith. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.